Okay, morning everyone. Welcome to this next session on enterprise-wide cyber incident response. This panel is going to discuss proactive tactics for rapid response. We've got a great panel lined up for you, and our moderator for this session is Andrew Kellett, who's Principal Analyst in Security at Ovum. And straight over to you, Andrew.
Okay. Wow, thank you all for coming and spending the time with us today. Very interesting subject, as far as I'm concerned, enterprise-wide cyber incident response. More importantly, the proactive things that we as users, we as organizations need to do to respond when problems occur. We've constantly been told that our systems are going to be breached, the cyber attackers are getting smarter, and the likelihood of them causing problems is growing. The problem isn't going to go away because there are so many incentives for stealing our data. But I could witter on about this stuff for hours, and you don't really want to hear from me because we've got an expert panel to talk about the subject. We've got people who are doing this stuff on behalf of their businesses on a daily basis. So what I like to do is introduce the panel and ask them individually to let us know how they see things, what's important to them, how you build up a proactive approach to dealing with cyber threats. So let's start with Andy Talbot on the far end here. And Andy is Director of Information Security at Amgen.
No, I wish I was. I'm head of global cyber defense at Vodafone.
Oh, sorry. But wrong end of the panel.
Does it pay more?
It's a good job, actually. But yeah. let's talk about that.
Okay, so thank you. So welcome, everybody. So when I was reflecting on this question, for me, the whole thing is about how do you become more proactive and how do you not get yourself into that space where you're dealing with incidents. And before we move to the far end of the spectrum and talk about advanced technologies and advanced processes, the first thing for me is about doing the basics well. And if you think about and you follow the trends, about 80% of incidents that we see are on the basis that somebody hasn't done that basic stuff well. So they haven't done the vulnerability scanning, they haven't done the patching, they haven't hardened to the level they need to do, and they don't, in some cases, know what actually needs to be scanned and remediated. And passwords at the right level, and you know, where needed, privileged user access and elevated privileges. So for me, the first thing about being proactive is do the basics well. The second thing is, we want to move collectively from being reactive to proactive, and organizations, not just ours, I think are starting to invest in much greater levels of threat intelligence. And the reason that we're moving in that direction is because that will help us understand actually the adversaries that are coming towards us. And certainly for us, that's a real focus area in terms of how we're trying to become more proactive and improve our incident response capability. And that comes in a number of guises. The first actually is being really clear about what's valuable to you. And you know, that in some organizations, particularly big organizations, is sometimes hard to get to the bottom of. But being very clear about what's valuable to you, what's valuable to the adversaries that you face, and how actually they will start to deploy their attacks against you. That will then really help you understand what that control and mitigation framework is that you put in place. Third thing is, we've all got security programs based on perceived threats, but you know, we need to make sure that they're adaptive. Attackers change their attack vectors, so we should be able to do that as well and become more agile in the way that we do it. From a people and an organisation point of view, we, like other organisations, spend a lot of time talking to our peers. You know, we try to pass information, we try to learn lessons. And I've met a couple of organisations recently that have got some really novel approaches to the people that they use to look at cyber and the cyber threats. And you know, they're employing data scientists. They've got no knowledge of security, but a brilliant data science to take all of the information in. Got people that have never worked in security but are great thinkers in different disciplines that are coming in to take that fresh look at the way that we do things. So that's there. And the final thing I'd say is organizationally, you know, when you have an incident, it's not the time to be trying to build relationships both internally and externally in the company. You've got to have these relationships well honed, well practiced, and be able to deploy them, you know, when you need to. So quite a lot of effort in that direction as well.
Thank you. Let it never be said, I don't play safe. Vicky Gavin, please, next. And Vicky is head of information security at the Economist Group.
Yeah, both information security and business continuity. And that's critical because I think the key, as far as I'm concerned, to a really good cyber response is making sure that every single person who works for The Economist knows what to do if we have an incident. And that means training and exercising and practicing so that when something bad happens, people know what to do. Because at the end of the day, something bad will happen. That's the only thing I can guarantee. Don't know what it'll be, don't know when it'll be, but it will happen. And no matter how high or how wide I build my technical walls, the criminals will get through it if they want to. So I'm not about to try and enter the cyber arms race. I'm going to instead count on my people to see the bad stuff happening and know how to react. And as I said, that's achieved through a regular program of both awareness and exercising. Everybody at The Economist gets at least one opportunity every year to participate in an exercise and practice responding to a cyber event. We have seen time and again when we have actual events that this is paying off. People know as it's happening, that's a cyber event, we know what to do. They pull together the response team. The response team all talk the same language, whether they're from IT, from the business, or from an external third party who we've engaged to help us with the response. Everybody knows what to expect from each other, and we're able to work through the incident and move forward. I say work through the incident because everybody always wants to know, have you got a cyber plan? We do. I keep it in the cupboard because everybody likes to be able to see a cyber plan. I mean, I think one of my favorite quotes of all time was Mike Tyson. Everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face. And that cyber attack is a punch in the face. The only thing I can guarantee at time of incident is that we won't have enough information, and at least half the information we have is wrong. But we still have to make decisions, and we still have to move forward. And so our whole crisis response strategy is based on making decisions without as much information as we'd like and ensuring that we can recover as quickly as is possible.
Thanks, Vicky. Right, jumping back then to Hempant, who is the CISO at Ing Bank, and it's the wholesale section of the bank.
Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. Hempant, I'm the CISO for wholesale banking globally. We operate out of 41 countries, so I think what both Andy and Vicky said, I'm completely in agreement with that. But I think with each organization, you learn quite a few other things. So for me, one of the challenges has been meeting with the various regulatory requirements also to deal with these kind of things. One of the things which we have started to see lately, and I think I can give an example of what's happened with Bangladesh, is that every regulator is suddenly waking up and saying, what are you guys doing about it? How are you dealing with it? So I think, yes, we have to take care of all the things about awareness and having a good governance around it, having technical solutions in place. But I think one of the challenges which large organizations and any organization is facing is the regulatory requirements also. And especially if you are like in an industry where you're dealing with data and money of other your customers, how do you ensure your customer feels safe about it? So I think that's one of the challenges which we have. And as an organization, that's one of the key things which we are trying to protect. How do you ensure and safeguard and provide that environment to your customers that they feel safe to engage and work with you? So I think that's led to a change in the way we do business and how we are looking at standardizing the things which we do. So what that meant was doing in different parts, we have kind of grown in silos like many large organizations do. So one of the key challenges for me is now to break those silos, ensure that the teams have a structured way of dealing with an incident. So recently I can give you an example, like the European Central Bank decided that all European banks have to report any cyber incident, a major cyber incident within 2 hours. This is a pilot they wanted to test with the European banks. And they said, ING, you are a European bank, come along and join this pilot. So that was a very interesting thing for us because if you look at it, typically looking at the reports, a typical time to find out an attack has happened is around 200 days. And suddenly you have a regulator who says, once you have it, you have to report it in 2 hours. So that meant looking at governance models, looking at how we train people, how they respond, how does the business is made aware of it, looking at your communication channels and establishing that. So we did a lot of work around it. And one of the other things which we found out that it was important that the management team members are also made aware of this because till now people, like even now I often hear that, oh, no, it's an IT risk, you know, IT teams will take care of it. So we have started changing the message. No, it's not. It's a business risk. Your whole business could be wiped out. So what can you do in partnership with us to ensure that we are building solutions and having tactical ways of bringing the business up in a case things go wrong. So we've started now having some awareness programs which are specifically aimed at the business management teams, at the board, but also, as you rightly said, we are as strongest as the weakest link. So how do we ensure that each of my team members and people who are accessing our data are made aware of things? So that's another area which we are trying to concentrate on is our third parties. Because as a bank, we do have to outsource a lot. And quite a few times, our walls would be strong, but vendors might not be. So that's another area of development which we are working at. And that's where we are.
Thank you very much. Obviously, identity theft is a problem for me. So let me introduce you to the real Kelvin Dickinson, Director of Information Security.
Thanks.
At Amgen.
Thank you. I was ticking away. I can talk about that. Nope, he's talking about it. I'll hit that note. Third party, great. But you bring up a really good point about third party risk management. I work for Amgen. Amgen's a biotech company, and we make drugs. Okay, we try and keep people alive as long as we possibly can. And I used to work for Electronic Arts, a gaming company. And when I ran incident response at EA, if we had an incident, we'd say, look, it's not all that bad, really. It's only a game at the end of the day. But working in the environment that I do now, when you start dealing with people's lives, it's completely different. And a couple of years ago, the board at Amgen decided that cybersecurity would be the top of the focus for investment within an organization. And we're very fortunate to have a board that proactively and reactively looks at how to invest in securing the systems and securing the data and securing the manufacturing principles that we have. So we went through a huge program of engagement with the rest of the business, and we talk about security awareness, and you talk about your stakeholders. And for me, it was identifying those key people within the groups that will help you, support you when in the event of an event or an incident or a crisis. And I found that getting closer to not just your forensics teams and your IT teams, and your boss, but you have to get close to your legal teams, you have to get close to your communications groups, you have to get close to your privacy teams, you have to get close to your regulatory teams. And it's not about having a plan. To Vicky's point, the plan is great, but the plan is there to guide you. You as an organization will set your appetite as to how you want to respond to a specific event. And over the course of the incident, as it develops, you will start to understand just what the impact of that event is going to be. And you can set the tone. You can set the detail of how you're going to follow a practice of notification to the various groups. We're now under the auspices of federal notification to the US state and to a number of individual states in the US, not to mention working with the works councils in Germany, having the various German laws, French laws, and the UK privacy laws too. As an incident commander, and from my role, we pay people a lot of money to know what to do and how to respond, so you can't take the whole world on your shoulders when you're dealing with it. But ultimately, you become that facilitator when those events happen. So the socialization of your plans and your response processes with the rest of the groups is really, really important. And that really is it for me. That's from an organizational standpoint. When you look at some of the big attacks that have happened in the recent years, one of the common vectors is using third parties. So your third party connectivity is as important as anything else that happens within your own internal organization. So those plans need to be socialized, not just within your own groups and not within your own organization, but you have to start engaging with very key third parties who have direct connectivity into your organization, because you are only as strong as your weakest link at the end of the day. And it's very, very important that you work closely with these people.
That was a very good summary, because it's actually going to lead into a question that I want to ask. Now, I want to make this a very interactive session, so I will open it up to the audience for questions in a moment or two. But let me just start with a question that follows on from what Calvin was talking about there. Basically, how much can we do ourselves? How much can we expect organizations to do on their own behalf? What elements of the proactive response can we share that responsibility with third-party providers, security companies, experts in the field? What can we afford to outsource? What should we be doing ourselves? And let's start with the financial services sector.
Sure. I think one of the learnings for us was, I think, as we started streamlining things, is that in a large organization, you also need to think of what could really happen if your whole bank was attacked at the same time. Do you have capabilities within your teams to react to an incident happening in multiple locations? So what we did after we came up with this thought process, and especially we had DDoS has become like an operational thing nowadays. So after those kind of activities, we thought, if we have such incidents, we need to have capabilities to be able to react to these kind of incidents in different geographies. How do we deal with it? So what we did was we started identifying global partners, not one, but four of them, with whom we could engage just in case, so that our team could still manage it, but they could still fly people to different locations. And the reason why we took four was because, for example, if you had an incident in Europe, there will be multiple financial organizations who are using one or two those vendors. So, and are they there in different geographies? So that's one of the key things which we have tried to change, is like, we have to remember you cannot handle everything on your own. You would need specialized help at some point of a time. And if it's like somebody is trying to run your bank down, then it becomes a challenge. And other part of it is we are creating a lot of runbooks. We are participating with, I think in the financial industry, one of the benefits is like most of them are aware of what needs to be done. So we share a lot of knowledge with the industry. There are industry-wide exercises which happen. So last year there was a big exercise with for a cyber attack against payment channels. So around 40 financial institutes participated in it simultaneously. We learned from it, and that helps in improving that runbook. Runbooks are important in a way because you're not just blindly getting on and trying to do things. You at least have a certain idea that if such a kind of situation happens, this is what I will try to do. And those are some of the subtle small changes which you've started to bring along and deal with these kind of things.
Okay. Calvin, you introduced the subject in your introduction. Do you want to take that further?
Yeah, for some of the larger organizations, we're very fortunate to have the funding behind you to engage with the major providers, your MSS, your incident responders, and your key vendors. who operate with some cutting-edge technology, and you just see it on the floor downstairs, the vast, ubiquitous nature of defenses that are now available to us. So we get some really good advice. We also work very closely with our smaller organizations and the smaller peers, and we leverage the size of us as an organization to help support that group. And we take a very altruistic approach to how we can support these smaller organizations. And in the US, we're part of an information sharing and advisory committee on the national health elements, of which Amgen is one, and we have a number of other major global pharma companies supporting us. And we engage with third parties to help develop support systems for the smaller organizations to tap into at reasonable prices which they can afford, because they shouldn't be eliminated simply because they can't afford it. And we as an organization really need to leverage our expertise and our opportunities working with these vendors to give these other guys a chance. Because at the end of the day, we're all in the same boat. We're all trying to achieve the same target, which is to prevent people from coming in and accessing our data and stealing our intellectual property. So we share IP addresses, we share threats, and we share intelligence, not just within that community, but also with the law enforcement teams as well. And I go back to what I said previously about the engagement. It's really important. You cannot remain siloed as a group with an incident response and cybersecurity team. You have to be much more proactive in reaching out to these other parties, but also ensuring that you support the other groups as well within the same industry as you to give them an opportunity to get access to it.
Okay, thanks. Vicky, I think in previous conversations we've had, I remember you talking about trusted partners.
Yeah, I was going to say, there is no right or wrong answer to this question. I mean, the degree to which an organization chooses to outsource depends on that organization. And The Economist is a relatively small organization. People always assume that we're actually quite large because so many people read our newspaper, but we're actually quite small. And so there are many technical skills that we just can't afford to keep a person with those kinds of skills on staff. I mean, first of all, they'd be bored to tears because we'd only use them once every 3 years. But the cost would be astronomical. And so we have a number of trusted partners that we work with, that we work with day to day on with various tasks, but that we can call on during an incident to provide forensic services, to provide reverse engineering services. I mean, all of the really highly technical skills that may be needed during a cyber incident. And because we have regular day-to-day relationships with them, we know that we have that trust level that we need to have them help us through an incident.
Thank you. Andy, the large enterprise perspective in the telecommunications industry?
Yeah, I think I've seen the whole spectrum from fully outsourced to fully insourced. And I think it depends on your maturity as an organization. And as you say, scale, and I agree with a lot of what Vicky's just said. Fundamentally, at the heart of it, you've got to make some decisions about your ability to retain and keep people, because security is a people business. You know, at the end of the day, when we're talking about these incidents, we may all have masses of technology, but it's people that are at the core of the response. And I think probably the key decision in deciding where you are on that scale is, you know, about how much you want to be in control of the decision making, because decision making is really what you're talking about when you're outsourcing stuff. How much of the decisions and incidents are you prepared to give to somebody else? So organizations will be somewhere on that spectrum, and for me it's about the people that you've got and the decisions you want to take yourself.
Okay. I just want to add one thing. I think one thing we all have to remember: whatever you do with outsourcing, it's still the organization's responsibility. It's still the organization's name which would, you know, be thrown around and would have the bad publicity. Your share prices would fall. So I think, as you rightly said, it's a well-balanced risk decision and the business decision where, at that moment of time, what kind of risks you're ready to take.
Yeah, you're right, Hem, because the two things you cannot outsource, the risk and your reputation.
Exactly, yep. And I think that's what you're playing with. So, can you afford to do that? How do you deal with it? So those are the things which we have to keep in mind when you're dealing with these kind of situations on a day-to-day basis?
Risk, reputation, responsibility. I think those all come together. Yeah.
Which comes back to your point about trusted partners. You know, as I said at the start, these relationships have got to be there before you get the incident. Incident is not the time to start building trusted relationships with people that you want to make critical decisions that may affect the risk of your business and its reputation.
Let's open it up. Who would like to come in with the first question? I think we've got a microphone to come down. Gentleman down here at the front.
Hi there, my name's Dave Marcel. We've just recently set up a DevSecOps group in the British Computer Society, putting the security in. So my question's related to that. Incident management, ultimately, we have soccer. And European football, on a football night, you've got set templates, not so different from what Hem's alluding to in incident response. Does the panel feel that there's room for these XML-style templates in our incident handling, whereby we can dynamically share to those that need, just like the type of goal that you get and the score, who did it, they can be pre-populated and dispatched in a matter of minutes. And if you've got a mobile phone app, you get the incident of a goal within a few seconds. So do you feel that incident handling is going to get to that stage?
Is it practical?
Again, I think it comes down to your organization and the nature of the events that you're facing. So I think there are some events that lend themselves to pre-populated messages, that sort of thing. The well-known frequent events that a large number of people know how to respond to. I generally don't actually class those as incidents. And I think that's where we need to start thinking about it. So for me, events are the things that are happening all day, every day, that you have business as usual processes in place to deal with. And you need to have that for an awful lot of the stuff that can happen. Then you go the next step up. When that ability to deal with it either exceeds your capacity, so you don't have enough people, or it exceeds your decision-making capability. So quite frequently, the people who have encountered the incident go, I don't know what to do with this. That's the point that it starts to become an incident, because you need extra attention to it, and whether it's just resources or decision-making, it's extra. And in my mind, it then goes from incident to crisis when, even with that extra level of attention, resource, and decision-making, it's starting to impact your reputation and or has the propensity to become even bigger. And then at that point, it's a crisis, and you really want a lot of extra attention applied to it. So I think at that lower end of the scale, there is a place for templates and for pre-formulated responses and so on, but certainly not at the top end.
Anyone else like to add to that?
Yeah, I think there are two factors I would like to add over here. So I think we are in a very data and knowledge-based industry. So the earlier you can get this data and information or knowledge about it, the better you can react, and lesser would be the cost or impact of having this thing. So yes, definitely there are talks in the industry about having such templates and dealing with this thing, and that's why you would realize that information sharing is so important. And if you look at it, it's the commoditization of this kind of tools. If you look at all the hackers and all, they share that information. They have the market to do this. And that's the same way now, you know, that's the reason why governments are forcing in some ways to make people speak about it. And for us, that's one of the challenges which we see in Europe. In Europe, we didn't have a kind of a liability from the government to say that you have to reveal about various incidents. And in the US, that was the case. So that's why organizations are some more mature in sharing that information. But now we are starting to see that same happening here in Europe. And so that's one of them. And I think in terms of getting this information and reacting to this, I think, yeah, definitely these kind of templates would help. And at least in the financial side, we have been talking about having standard templates. And yeah, exactly. It's all about not just your bank. How do you safeguard the industry? How do you safeguard a industry? So I think that's the mindset which people are starting to develop and keep it in place.
Okay. Do we have any follow-up questions? Anybody else in the room? Lady at the front here.
Hi. Interesting discussion. I'm currently doing a PhD research on incident response, and the message I'm hearing is awareness and information sharing. And I think Ham, like, yeah, pointed out that, you know, the EU is heading towards the US framework, which is information sharing. I'm very interested in getting raw data by interviewing people like yourself for my PhD. So I hope I can get some information sharing from the panel. Is that something that you're willing to participate in my research?
We can talk offline, definitely.
Okay, thank you very much. Interesting.
Bye. On the topic of information sharing, I mean, I think the very fact that we're all up here talking about this today suggests that we all believe that information sharing is a good thing. It's interesting. In regulated industries, governments are now saying, oh, you must share information. But I work in an unregulated industry, and we have had both US and UK-based information sharing groups that we have participated in for more than 5 years. And I think if we were to do a straw poll and maybe everybody, by show of hands, who has participated in one way or another with sharing information about crime with others in your field?
Let's do that. Let's look around the audience.
My estimate would be that's about 50% of the members of the audience are already doing this. So.
What about the telco industry?
Yeah, I think in some ways we're behind the financial services industry. I think you guys have been sharing information for a long time. It's a lot more formalized. We're starting to do that. And I don't think it's just about within industry and sectors, actually. I think some of the vendors that we all work with are starting to create interesting groups that cut across sectors where we start to see things that are interesting in terms of our incident response. So I certainly see a lot more of information sharing going on. I think we'll see even more. And what's interesting is I think we're starting to see self-forming groups as well.
Yep.
So it's not government or it's not a vendor or it's not an industry group that's doing it. It's individuals like us that sit in the panel saying, I need to go and talk to that person over there because they might have something that's interesting to me. I think the challenge for us is how we make that sharing effective and timely, because that's what's going to help us get in front of the curve. This is all about time at the end of it and making sure that you can be proactive before what happens to one of these three people comes and happens in my environment. So the more we share, I think it's one of the biggest things, actually, that will help us get to where we need to be in terms of being proactive.
I think last point to add, the UK government has been doing quite a lot of things around this. So the CISP platform has been established, which caters to all the industries. And I think if you join CISP, you learn a lot. There's been a lot of information sharing across industries, what's happening in the UK industry as such. So I think it's a partnership between the government, the industries, and it's... As I said, it's all about the data, the knowledge, and the information. So,
Kelvin, what are you seeing?
We, we're a global company, so we have challenges right across the board from a regulatory perspective and a disclosure. But certainly, we have benefited from working very closely with the sort of three-letter organizations, law enforcement teams in the US, principally because that's where all our data is held. And working very closely with our peers in the industry has enabled us to build a very sort of not necessarily full predictive analytical approach to how the attacks are going to happen, but certainly in combination with your service provider who actually see these on a regular basis enables you to develop a certain pattern and type of attack that you see. What that does help you do is to set a appetite and a risk threshold as to what you regard as low, medium, high, and critical. And the more mature you become, the higher up the threshold you're enabling your business to operate at, so the risk tolerance and risk appetite becomes more acceptable. But that's only as good as the defenses that you have in place. And I go to Andrew's opening speech when he suggested that we deal with this on a daily basis. Fortunately, I don't deal with an incident on a daily basis, but our technology does. And it's running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We're actually responding to the severe threats that come through that are actually created. And that connection between the human analytical side of things and the electronic side of things is very important. But certainly that spouts out all of the data and all the information. We will pump that back into the sharing opportunities that we have with our groups to say we're seeing a trend of a particular IP coming from a particular country. You might want to be aware of that. And then that can be filtered into the broader threats that you're seeing from new malware strains and anything else that's coming out in the big industry.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you all. Do we have another question from the audience? Gentlemen down there.
This is Shavinder from Societe Generale, France. So my question is for Vicky. Actually, we had an interesting discussion regarding information sharing. And my question is regarding awareness. You mentioned that awareness is really important. What kind of methods you find that are really efficient, and how you measure the efficiency before we get the punch on the face?
I'm not sure I understand.
Sorry,
the
could
question.
You just give us that one again, please?
So it's regarding the awareness. What kind of awareness programs and methods you find more efficient, and how you measure the efficiency?
Okay. So in terms of awareness and particularly around incident response, it's really important that the awareness training and whatnot that we do match up to the actual threats that we face. So we've spent some time analyzing what it is we at The Economist need to be worried about. And what we've determined is that nobody is going to start a war by issuing a cyber attack on The Economist. So we're not preparing for cyber war. Although we have a fair amount of intellectual property around, in general, we publish it every week, so we really only try to keep it secret for a few days. So cyber espionage, not particularly a threat to us. I mean, we need reasonable controls, but it's not our biggest worry. Cyber crime, you know, fraud and that sort of thing. We have the same risk as anybody else, and there are much richer targets out there. But the thing that we have that's different from anyone else is we have been publishing our newspaper for over 170 years. And throughout that history, we have had regular, almost monthly, letters from subscribers who didn't like what we had to say. And some of those people have been quite threatening in their tone. And it doesn't take a lot of imagination to figure out, sooner or later, somebody with a computer is going to think, I know how I'm going to get them. And so the threat that's biggest for our organization is hacktivism, and the hacktivist weapon of choice is the phishing email. And so for my organization, the key thing that I am training every single person to do is to identify a phishing email, don't click on the link, and let me know when it's happened. And the way I did that was to start a phishing contest. I told everybody what a phishing email looked like, and for 5 weeks, every time somebody sent me a phishing email, and whether they got it at home or at work or from their husband or wife or dog or cat, I didn't care, they got a raffle ticket for a security blanket. Now, the security blanket was a beautiful handmade quilt, not something ratty. And at the end of 5 weeks, every single person in my organization knew how to identify a phishing email. And that information has stuck with them ever since. Every couple of years, we do a refresher. But once people know something, you can count on them to continue knowing that forever. And I can say, hand on heart, we're pretty certain that when the Syrian Electronic Army was attacking media outlets, that they tried to attack us three times. And all three times, the recipient of that phishing email said, that's a phishing email, sent it to me and my team, and we were able to stop it at the door. So it works.
So different industries, different perspectives. I guess the other three members of the panel will have something different to say here.
Andy? Yeah, so I wholeheartedly agree with what you've just said. I think it's about capturing people's imagination, actually. So in my previous organization, we actually had a range of threats that we identified, one being as simple as, you know, people tailgating through the door. And what we did was, at the time, we were watching YouTube and finding videos that actually caught the imagination and became viral. So we got a bunch of comic actors in, and we created our own viral, comedies, in short. And just because they were funny, they were short, and they caught people's imagination, we watched them and we tracked them on our social media internally and watched people start to send them, watch them. And that was a really clever way of getting the message out in a non-typical security way, actually, because sometimes we send stuff out that we think's interesting, but to the majority of the business, they're not necessarily that interested in security. It's something else that arrives in their email box or in a newsletter that they have to read. So it's about capturing people's imagination for me.
The industry itself is looking at the gamification approach to this. Is that something that you're considering at the moment?
So I think we have started doing that. So and I think what we've started doing with that is, like, we at least have a blanket approach which covers everyone who touches an ING system. So we have training and awareness plans for those. And one of the things, from a standardization perspective, you want to ensure that each of your regions get the same message, so developing it in multiple languages. Another key thing is, like, engaging the business, because one of the mindsets which we have seen is that people always consider cyber and these kind of risks as IT risk, and reiterating to them that it's not, it's a business risk. So from a gamification perspective, we have developed a program now which we have been running successfully for the last year or so. I've personally trained a few of my board members in different regions about this, and we are seeing immense benefits out of it. So it gives them a hands-on approach. First, we talk to them about what's happening in the industry, give them keywords, and then we let them play a game to say, now you have to protect yourself. So how are you going to, what are the kind of things you will do? And we let them run a session with them for an hour. And when they actually personally get involved in it, that's when they start learning. And I think the benefit which I have started seeing is more open channels and communication when they're engaging in new assignments and arrangements, or they're thinking more, like me in some way. So I want everyone in my organization to at least think a bit like me. And I think, as you rightly said, then everyone becomes, so I personally call this concept the human firewall. I need each of my individual members to be that firewall for me. The challenge is big, but slowly and steadily we'll get there.
For us, it's about the demystification of information security. It's one of them subjects that a lot of people want to get involved with, but they're not sure how to. Yep. And equally, it is important to the business. And every single individual in our organization is invited to participate in a program which we have called Sentinels. And we have Chief Sentinels, where we have a security advocacy program across the business. And you empower people to become a security representative within their specific business unit that you can work with directly, because they understand the threats probably better than you do. They know their data better than you do. They know some of the risks far better than you do, and they know the impact as well. So actively engaging with key individuals across the organization, it's not just done in isolation with one information security team. We make everybody information security advocates, to the extent that our chief executive over in the US has a lanyard with Sentinels on, and he is a chief sentinel, and he's undergone that training himself. With regards to the patch quilt, we'd rather go for a three strikes and you're out approach if your phishing gets caught. So three strikes and you're out doesn't mean you lose your job, but it does mean that you could lose your connectivity onto the network until you go some remedial training, for want of a better word.
I think, just to add on to this, we actually did a fun exercise. So we tried to have different awareness exercises for different groups. So last year, we actually had an InfoSec conference for ING folks across in Frankfurt. And we actually had a session over there where each team was asked to break locks. So we gave them lock breaking sets, and you said 15 minutes, and there's a competition, so we broke them into teams and said, try and pick these locks. How quickly can you do that? We showed them a small video from YouTube saying, this is how you do it. Now it's a competition, three teams, start breaking locks. So we started off with the first a physical exercise, how to break locks, and then we had actually set up various fake websites for them to figure out things, and you know, it went all till night, 2 o'clock, and yeah, we had fun.
Okay. So we've talked about the threats, we've talked about the proactive responses, we've talked about the sharing of responsibilities, we've talked about the training. What about after the security breach? What should the public response look like? Who should talk on behalf of the organization? We've seen some pretty poor examples of it of late, so what's your take on how an organization should respond, remembering that they're going to be in the media spotlight?
I can start with ours. We have a trusted third-party PR firm that we call in to join the crisis team anytime we get to the level where we think a public response may be required. And they are there from square one. They know what everybody's thinking, the choices that we're making, why we're making those choices, and they can then coach all of the various staff members, from the customer service people who might get a question through to the CEO who could end up with a camera in his face, on how to respond to those questions.
Okay. Calvin.
We go back to planning and preparing and engagement, and the communications team are absolutely critical. And you have to remember that as an organization, you will be penalized not on the way you actually react to the incident and how you handle it, but more your public response and your engagement. And that's where a lot of the fines have come through in the US, as to how organizations have actually been public facing about what they do and the honesty and transparency. But for us, it's actually dealing with those individuals that are impacted directly as a result of it. And then you can start looking at your broader audience from a broader messaging perspective. But it is really being about as transparent as your legal team will allow you to be transparent. And advertise, not necessarily advertising that you've had the breach, but there is a particular timing and criticality when you determine that you have been subjected to a breach, that another session kicks in with your communications groups to start planning for that broader advertisement.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with that. And it goes back to your point earlier, actually, which is about the broad range of teams that you need to have involved around you, because sometimes it's head down, we're in the middle of the incident, but you need to have that wider engagement. And I think your point about timing is right. The time that you set yourself to get the perfect information, you're never going to get to make the decision about, you've got enough to understand what it is, start the remediation, and you know, absolutely tell the people whose data or have suffered the breach, you know, before it's out in the public environment. That timing of when you make that announcement is absolutely, because you want to be seen as transparent, yeah. But you want to have enough to say, I've got confidence in what's happened, and this is what I've done about it, actually. This is what I'm doing about it, because some cases it will be ongoing over a period of time. But you know, the support of PR agencies, the other teams around you, is absolutely critical, because it's not a decision you can take on your own. And actually, you need to keep everybody from the CEO downwards involved in the whole of that decision, because ultimately they're responsible for the reputation of the business, and they will have to make some calls about what that timing is.
And there are specific actions that you'll take internally as well that could impact. Because let's say, for argument's sake, you do suffer a breach, and that will result in you having to undergo an enterprise-wide password reset process. People are going to think, oh, really? What's happening? Yeah. Okay, so the messaging around that whole password reset process is absolutely critical. And there's no harm in you telling them that the organization has come under a specific threat, and as a result of that threat, you're undergoing some proactive measures to ensure that the safety of the data and the patient data is
I think
maintained.
Final word from him.
So from our side, we have very clear rules around this. Not everyone gets to speak to the journalists as such. So there is a clear guidance that we have a team which will deal with this. As an organization, we also have a crisis management organization, which comprises of the business leaders, the IT, the legal, the risk, the compliance, name it, they're there. So they're there in that team. They're the leaders of the team to understand. And then they have a crisis communication plan. So if things go wrong, how do you actually start dealing with this? And this team meets up, and they also have a fallback plan. So if things really go back, how do they ensure that, for example, if your email infrastructure breaks down or your telephones break down, can they physically meet in some room? Is there a secure channel for them to communicate? So thinking about all of that. And then ensuring that you're transparent to your stakeholders. That's the key thing which we keep reiterating to the team. And you know, revealing those facts which make sense. If you're not yourself clear about it, do not speak about it. And that's recently what's got highlighted in quite a few incidents, that if you're not clear, do not speak about it. Give a transparent view of where you are.
Sadly, our time is up. There are so many other subjects that we could have covered. Could I ask you to put your hands together and a round of applause for a very informative panel? And it would be very remiss of me not to ask you to complete your evaluation forms and let Vicky have those back at the end of the session. Thank you for spending this hour with us, and I hope it's been very informative. Thank you.